This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/sjcgi for more information. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/sjcgi.
If you go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/store, you're going to see the 2016 Partially Examined Life calendar featuring the ultra-cool artwork of Sterling Bartlett. If you enter the offer code CALENDAR5, that is calendar and the number 5, at checkout, you'll get $5 off your calendar order. Thanks and enjoy the episode. You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 131 is something like, what is the mind? And we're following up on episode 130, where we read books 1 and 2 of Aristotle's De Anima, by this time adding book 3, which concerns the intellect. You can join the discussion, get the texts, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer at One with the Noose in Madison, Wisconsin.
That's terrible.
This is Seth Paskin with a Tier 2 translation in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allen with an active and passive mind in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey moving myself in Middleton, Wisconsin.
What is the mind is a very misleading title for this episode.
What do you mean? We got sensation. We're going to finish up
intellect,
the part in
imagination.
Book 2 of perception. We got
thinking.
Exactly. Locomotion.
And they're all different.
Yes, but mind is such a loaded modern term.
Yes. Did you read the Putnam and Nussbaum?
Yeah, so we should mention that in addition to book 3 here, one thing Wes recommended was this book, Essays on Aristotle's De Anima, 1985, edited by Martha Nussbaum and Amelie Oxenberg-Rorty, which included an essay by Nussbaum and Hilary Putnam, Changing Aristotle's Mind. I read that, and I also read it was a response to the article right before that, M.F. Bernyeats, Is an Aristotelian Philosophy of Mind Still Credible? And as is normal when I read secondary literature like that, I found myself, as I was reading Bernyeat, I'm like, yeah.
I think it's Bernyeat.
Bernyeat? Okay. As I was reading Bernyeat, I was thinking, yeah, this is right. This is how Aristotle goes. And then I read the one directly contradicting him and said, no, actually, this is right. It was very long. It was very exhausting, really interpretively thorough, but threw out a lot of parts of relevant texts adjacent to De Anima, De Sensu, and things from the metaphysics and other stuff.
De Motu.
Yes.
So I will recommend, just since we're mentioning this, a few other things for people who want to get their heads around De Anima and Aristotle. Probably the first thing I would recommend is Jonathan Lear's Aristotle, The Desire to Understand. Really great introduction to Aristotle. And there's a book by Christopher Shields, which I think is just called Aristotle. That's also very helpful. And then I think we already mentioned this, but we've used this line by line. Unfortunately, I didn't read most of it for this one, for book 3. But this line by line commentary by
Eugene
Gendlin, who's a philosophy professor and a psychologist, interestingly enough. So,
yes, I actually got pretty damn far into that. I got through over half the book is endnotes. So I didn't read any of the endnotes, but I got 45% or something like that, according to my Kindle, into the book, which was all the way up into the last chapter, chapter 13, which is kind of a silly chapter that I don't care that I didn't read the interpretation of that. But it was a great way of refreshing and deepening my understanding of the text. And it reads fast. I mean, I read most of that today. So.
Yeah, so now for the actual text, which despite all of my reading, I still feel like I can't do justice to, but I find this enormously complicated, and when I read the secondary literature, I realize how little I've understood in my first reading, and so it's just more than anything else we've read, I find this to be the most challenging.
So it's 13 chapters, and we also didn't really talk about the second half of book 2, which is about perception, which kind of starts off, really the perception stuff is continued by the beginning of book 3 there, about how the senses work, which sort of at a very high level, you know, he uses the word motion a lot. And I mean, motion can refer to any kind of change. But in the case of perception, at least the way Aristotle was always presented to me, is it's meant quite literally that there's emotion going through the air. Like when you see something, it's not necessarily a beam of light. It's something, a piece of the air affecting the piece of the air next to it, affecting the piece of the air next to it, etc., which then affects the appropriate sense organ. And that sense organ has to be tuned to that particular kind of sensory data. And so it moves in the appropriate way. And putting this in terms of form is it adopts the form of the thing that you're perceiving. Of course, it doesn't adopt the matter. So if you see a dog, it has the potential, your eye, to become dog-like, but it doesn't actually turn into a dog. It somehow, at some level, adopts the form of the dog.
Right. Yeah, he puts it just that way. It takes in the form without taking in the matter.
We should be careful about that term form, right? It's not like it's the shape of the dog exactly, right?
But it's not the essence either, because it'll turn out that the thing that we use to grasp essences will be nous or intellect. So
yep.
I've seen this called a lot perceptible form in the secondary literature. So it's the form in the sense of the appearance of the thing. So it's not like we take in the essence of dog through our senses. That's open to inquiry, right? That would be like taking in H2O through our senses as opposed to the sensible qualities of water. So yeah, so when he says form, I think, yeah, he means something very specific there.
Apropos of some of the stuff we read, and then also just thinking about the difference between perception, just the reflected light or something like that, something completely received.
This is Gendlin's take on him, at least, is that he's not an atomist, is that when we take in the form of a thing, we are not perceiving sense data, which we then construct into a thing. Mm-hmm. We grasp the thing. So it's seeing the dog as a whole creature, it standing out as a thing from the background. So in that sense, yeah, we're not getting the deep essence of it, but we are getting at it as a...
As a whole.
Yeah, as a whole. I was going to say even it as the fact that it is an animal, the fact that it is a moving creature, but here... That might be getting too far into the essence, and you would need nous to...
But some of that is all part of form, being able to take in the fact that it's alive versus dead. Mm-hmm. But besides just getting the whole of it and not being an atomist with respect to it, it's also not as if that whole is an assemblage based upon those atomistic things, right? For Aristotle, he's saying you're going to get these raw... signals coming into your eyes and into your nose and your senses, and then you will assemble out of that a dog.
Yep.
It's that you perceive the dog.
Mm. Right. That's another thing Gendlin was very adamant about, that the different senses work together very tightly. It's not like it is for Kant, where we, again, use the senses to more or less take in sense data, and then the intellect assembles them.
Yes.
Into the creature. This actually all happens on the level of the senses. And his story about that is pretty elaborate, but it's a matter that if you do isolate the smell from the sight of something, then that's an abstraction. What you take in is, again, not just even the shape of the dog, but it is the whole thing as it normally comes in its multisensory way. So there's a physiological story to be told about how the different senses then come together at a place that he thinks is the heart, but it is the place of common sense, which is a funny use of the term, that is common to all the senses, which Gendlin made a big deal out of, but I wasn't sure that I completely understood why that was so important.
Well, the idea is that there's the question of how we know through all the different senses, how we attribute all of those sensations to one thing. And we might give an account in which we taste and touch and smell something, and then there's another faculty that tells us that all of these qualities belong to the same substance outside of us, or the same thing. And I think that's kind of Descartes' account, right? When he talks about the melting of the wax and the way in which we intellectually intuit a substance underneath all the changing qualities. For Aristotle, there is no separate organ or faculty, however you want to put it. The organ is more the material substrate of the faculty, right? So there's no sixth faculty that's going to help us unite all of the different senses. Common sense inheres in the main five senses themselves.
Yeah, so the very act of perceiving is that putting together is happening there. It's not merely an activity of intellect or thinking. He does make a distinction between perceiving and thinking and imagination. But perceiving looks a lot like what we often hear about as thinking modernly because of the way in which we often talk about mind and thinking as being the raw signals on the one hand that then get put together by this thing called mind, which is not Aristotle's story at all.
So we should say we're talking about what he calls the, in my translation, the common sensibles.
Can you give a line number?
Yeah. So the 425A15. So as motion, rest, shape, magnitude, number, and unity.
We perceive all these through movement.
Yes.
Rest through absence of movement, number through negation of continuity, and also by the special objects. I was really surprised by this, that if you recall our Henri Bergson episode, that was supposed to be a big deal for him, that, hey, if you actually pay attention to the phenomenology, the movement is a basic thing that we perceive. We don't put movement together. We don't perceive sense data and then somehow construct movement out of it, but movement is basic. I always thought Aristotle was one of the people that he was targeting with that, that Aristotle laid the groundwork for this horrible thing that had to be overcome. But no, I think it's more Descartes. And
yeah, it's Descartes and Newton, right?
Yeah. And here it is right in Aristotle.
Yep. Movement is a primary thing.
So what does he mean by, and I found that commentators are actually quite puzzled by this as well. What does it mean that we figure all these things out through movement, or that we perceive them through movement? Are we inferring magnitude?
I mean, I think magnitude is the easiest one, and maybe also figure in the sense of both are extension. So you perceive magnitude by essentially going from one end to the other. It's something that takes time.
Moving your eyes.
Yeah. Just as a slight aside, I was somewhat surprised to, in, I don't remember if it was in book three, if it was earlier in book two, to have him talking about geometrical figures and talking about lines being generated by the movement of points. And the reason I was surprised is I associate that so much with a Cartesian generation of a line through moving a point.
Hmm.
So what I'm hearing you guys saying is that you're talking about common sensible objects,
mm-hmm.
or a common sensible object. And his distinction, which I thought was kind of cool, was that there are five special types of sensible objects that have correspondingly five special organs, which are sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch, each of which has its own special object, which we'll get to in a second. And then he says, there are common sensible objects, which are movement, rest, shape, size, number, and unity, any of which, those common, can be perceived by any one of the other senses. So the fact that you can perceive magnitude or size both through touch or by sight means that there's something different about magnitude than there is about, for example, color, which is something you can only perceive by sight. So he's just creating this distinction between, and I was still stuck on the idea of the use of the term perception and organ and sensible object, to not abstract from that level to something more sophisticated.
That's a good way of explaining it, yeah.
Yeah, that was awesome.
I'm still puzzled by the whole movement thing, but yeah.
Well, and it makes it more puzzling the way Seth just put it, that if the common sensibles, any of the senses could get at them, well, how could you smell a line through movement? Like, what would that possibly mean?
Well, it doesn't mean that any sense can get it. It means that the common sensibles are common simply because they're not unique to any one particular sense. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you can determine a line through both sight and touch, or you might potentially be able to maybe smell and taste have something in common. Maybe there are common objects that there are ways that you could do that. I'm not sure. But that's the only significance of saying that they're common, not that every single sense shares them or can equally distinguish.
Yeah, there's actually a point, I forget where this is, where he sort of wonders why we have so many different senses. And he seems to say that the multiplicity of senses is the only way we could actually get at the common sensibles, just in the way you're suggesting, Seth.
It's the last paragraph of the first section of book three. One might inquire why it is that we have several senses rather than just a single one. Or is it so that the accompanying and common things, like motion, magnitude, and number, should not go unrecognized? If there were only sight, and it was of the white, we would more easily fail to notice them, and all things would even seem to be the one same thing because of the way color and magnitude keep company with one another. As it is, since the common things also dwell in another kind of sensible, this makes it clear that each of them is something distinct. So I guess what he's saying is that the fact that we can detect the common sensibles with multiple senses is the indication that they are different from their distinct things.
Yeah, and this goes back to something, I can't remember if it was Wes or Mark said earlier, about he makes a point of saying that there's no special organ. There's no special organ for the common sensibles. There's no...
The movement detector, yep.
Magnitude detector.
Right, there's no magnitude detector, but that it's this combination of the senses working together that, in a certain sense, I mean, what I heard you just say, Dylan, I'm struggling with how to articulate this, is in order to be able to get at all those common sensibles, we need just this combination of special senses, sight, taste, you know, hearing, all that together, that make it so that we can get at unity and movement, size, all those things in just the right way. I think he needs to lay that groundwork because he's saying there is no sense organ, and because he doesn't have a concept of consciousness, that he's got to have some way to explain how we can get at those things without basically creating a structure of the soul that has seven more additional organs, all of which have those special sensible objects.
But isn't it in some ways, this is like the first and sort of lowest example of what we were talking about at the very beginning of the distinctive way perception works for Aristotle, that it's something that is active and multifaceted. You're perceiving magnitude and figure directly through the interactivity of your basic senses, but that is the activity of perceiving. And he himself asked this question, which we just read, why is it that we would have this sort of multifaceted ability? And the fact that he asked that question makes me think that he has a predisposition to having sort of one-to-one correspondences between things at times, despite the fact that he has this thick notion of perception.
Mm. So one of the things that's fun about reading Aristotle is that you can construct for yourself a thought process of like how he's trying to solve a problem. For example, you know, like we experience size and movement. How does that happen? Well, we can see things, but seeing is not the same as this. And you can imagine him puzzling through. And one of the things that's interesting about this distinction, I think it comes up a little later, but he mentions it several times through the text, is he talks about there being a surplus. A surplus of a thing can damage a sense.
Yeah, that's right. You can overwhelm the sense and destroy it.
You can overwhelm the sense and destroy it. Imagine him sitting there thinking, okay, well, if you have an overabundance of light, you can be blinded, or an overabundance of sound and you can be deafened. But you can have an overabundance of number and nothing happens. There's nothing that gets debilitated by too much of something or too big a thing or too much movement in a thing. And you just imagine him trying to figure out, okay, well, how do I explain that? How can I explain that you have senses that can be overwhelmed by objects, but there are other objects that no matter how much of them there are, how little of them there are, they have no impact? It's a great question.
Yeah. Well, I think you can ask, why is this starting off book three? Why isn't he just continuing book two here? And it's because he's building up to talking about the intellect. And you might think that the intellect is another sense, you know, a distinct sense. And so he wants to, he's going to eventually say that the intellect has things in common with the senses in that it too is a potentiality that somehow adopts the forms of the things that it thinks about in the same way that the sight adopts the forms of the things that you see, but it's not a sense.
Before we get to that though, because he has a new account of what sensation is in this.
Yeah.
So beginning at 425b 27.
So this is in chapter three. In chapter three.
The beginning of book three, he does exactly with the primary senses and perception what Mark was talking about emphasizing potential, not just with thinking, that the thing that perception has in common with thinking is potentiality.
Yeah.
And that comes out in the second section.
Yeah, so let me read some of this because it's pretty stunning, actually.
So this is actually chapter two, the third section.
He gave the line numbers.
Oh, sorry. I thought you meant book three.
Yeah, it's book three, section two. Yeah, chapter. And the line numbers were right, yeah.
So it's 425B27. The activity of the sensible object and of the sensation is one and the same, though their essence is not the same. In saying that they are the same, I mean the actual sound and the actual hearing, for it is possible for one who possesses hearing not to hear, and that which has sound is not always sounding. But when that which has the power of hearing is exercising its power, and that which can sound is sounding, then the act of hearing and the act of sound occur together. We may call them respectively audition and sonance. So what I find fascinating about this is just this idea of, well, first of all, he's addressing this sort of classic Berkeleyan question of whether if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, was there really a sound?
Yes.
And his answer is, in a sense, yes, and in a sense, no. So
that's a very Aristotelian answer.
Yeah. So there is sonance, but not audition. But
because it wasn't heard, there was no sound.
But there is a sound in the sense that it engages in the activity. So first of all, there's the potential for sound in this particular object. And then something happens. It results in its activation. It becomes actually sonant or something, however you want to.
Let's call it the first actuality.
Right. So the second actuality would be its capacity to give off a sound, and then the first actuality would be its giving off a sound.
No. The second actuality would be it actually being heard. That's the way its potentiality.
Right. I got them backwards. But I think there's different layers here. So once it's giving off a sonance, it has the potential to be heard, and then there's a potential for a hearing being to hear that sound. And when the two come together, what I find fascinating about this is they're essentially engaged in the same activity. So when the two don't come together, it's the activity of sonance by itself. But when there's actual sound and actual hearing, they are the same thing.
It's like a chemical reaction that the two things are coming together to make the sound. The difference between that is that that sounds like that both of them change. And he's very adamant that the sounding thing, though it causes us to hear it, is the actor. Does not itself have to change as a result of us hearing it. It doesn't care whether we hear it or not.
But they're being at work, the sounding thing and the hearing thing, when they're interacting, they're doing it on the same thing, not just incidentally at the same time.
Right. They're doing it onto the organism. The organism is the receiver, is the thing that is being changed, the thing that is adopting a form.
Yes.
But the point is that what we call a sound is actually this joint activity of subject and object that can be broken apart into audition and sonance if we look at it that way.
But by the logos, but they're not, properly speaking, separable.
Yeah, not in the act of hearing are they separable. But the separability comes about when the possibility of no one being there to hear it, and then you just have the...
Yeah.
And in that case, there's still an activity. There's still an activity of the sensible object, but it's not this unified subject-object activity.
Hey, before we get into that, Wes, why don't you tell us about our new sponsor?
So we'd like to thank our new sponsor, HelloFresh.com, for supporting PEL. HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that makes cooking far more convenient. They send all the ingredients you need along with easy-to-follow recipes that take about 30 minutes to make. I'm going to sound like more of an evangelist on this one than usual because I've actually been doing this for about 6 months, and it's something I already recommend to people on a regular basis. And before I started doing this, I was not the kind of person who did any cooking because there was no way I was going to actually do the meal planning and then go to the grocery store and then come back and cook because, the few times when I did do that, usually I did not get good results, and then the rest of the produce would just rot in the fridge. But what I found is that with the meal planning taken care of and the ingredients just sent to me, I don't have to go to the grocery store. I don't have a problem cooking 3 times a week, especially when the meals come out so well. And I think part of that is just they have really clear recipes and instructions. And the other part is the quality of the ingredients, which is way higher, in my experience, than what you get at a regular grocery store. So they're sourced from local farms. And I actually went out to the grocery store and got some cilantro to compare it to some of the cilantro I had been sent. There's just no comparison. So think of it like the kind of stuff you would get at a farmer's market. So recipes include things like winter risotto with kale, fennel seed and parmesan, or Turkish meatballs with parsnip and creamy polenta. And you can find more on the HelloFresh website. Since I started doing this, I've felt way healthier. It's been part of my weight loss plan. I've lost a lot of weight recently because I find that eating less processed food, I'm not eating as much. Our audience can get $35 off their first week of deliveries by going to HelloFresh.com and subscribing with offer code PEL. That's HelloFresh.com, offer code PEL.
And our other sponsor for this episode is pretty relevant to what we've been doing today, because this sort of textual analysis is exactly the kind of thing that goes on at St. John's College Graduate Institute, which Dylan and Wes here have both been associated with.
Well, yeah, I went to St. John's, the undergraduate arm, and then Dylan was a tutor. The Graduate Institute is a two-year degree, which is very similar in structure to the undergraduate degree, which is this program where you read books and you sit around a seminar table and talk about them.
The classroom is really a conversation with students right at the center of it, not a lecture given by a tutor in which the students are asking questions or the tutor is running a discussion, but a conversation about the text.
So that means that if you like to partially examine life, in a way, what happens in the classroom at St. John's is similar to a partially examine life episode. It's a real back and forth. It's a real conversation.
But more boring or less boring.
But it doesn't have Mark's snarky...
There's less cussing.
So the Graduate Institute is currently accepting applications. They're accepted on a rolling basis. There's no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field.
If you're interested in reading original texts, sort of unedited and unmediated, and learning them through conversation with interested people... And also, if you're interested in a huge swath of intellectually interesting material, not just philosophy, but also science and mathematics, religion and literature, St. John's College Graduate Institute covers all those bases. And the Graduate Institute also has a Eastern Classics program.
For 20% off your first year tuition.
Yeah. In addition to the degree-granting programs... There are also summer educational opportunities, a 9-week ancient Greek institute, an 8-week film studies program, and 2-week-long science institute programs. For more information, go to partiallyexaminelife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminelife.com/SJCGI.
Okay, thanks. So back to Aristotle. Now, is it an accident that he uses the term object of perception all over the place, but he doesn't actually use the term subject at all?
Where is an example of object of perception?
Well, in my translation, 426A15, since the activity of the object of perception and of that which can perceive...
Yeah, so the object of perception is literally the thing perceived. It's the tu, aesthetu. So it's just he's using what they call a substantive. So you can translate it as object if you like, but he's just saying the thing perceived.
In my translation, it's called what? This guy uses the instead of activity, uses being at work. And since the being at work of what can perceive and of what is perceptible is one, right?
Right.
Their being is different. It is necessary for hearing and sound meant in this way to perish or be preserved together, as well as flavor and taste, and likewise the others. But when these things are meant as potential, it is not necessary. So you can separate them from one another, in which case you end up intrinsically talking of potential. So, you know, the tree falling in the forest, if there isn't an entity hearing it, then you end up having to talk about it has the potential of being heard, but the full subject-object relationship isn't there, and the full being at work of it, of both of them, would be in that interactive moment.
Yeah, they would actually be one energeia, one activity or being at work.
Exactly, one being at work in which you had an emitter and a receiver, that they're in symbiosis.
But the point is, it's not, I think, and Mark was saying this, it's not like the perceptible thing affects us, affects our faculty. Rather, we have a potentiality and it rises to the occasion. It becomes activated. It's almost like they go out to meet each other. So we are activated and the object is activated and then the activities unite. But Mark, you were talking about this lack of the use of subject.
Well, yeah, and I was getting at one of the themes of this Nussbaum Putnam article, which emphasizes how prescient and relevant in a post-Cartesian world Aristotle is in his epistemology because it avoids the mind-body distinction and the gulf between subject and object and all these things that we've talked about that we blame Descartes for and then say that the later phenomenologists, Hegel and Heidegger and folks like that, and then also people like Dewey, then overcame that actually this stuff is not in Aristotle in the first place if you read him right. Not seeing the word subject there is something that I was taking as evidence of that, that he's talking about, you know, obviously we're talking about organisms. We're talking about organisms that are alive, that have some sort of functional unity about them. That's the whole point in talking about the soul. And the soul has all these different parts that hook together in different ways. And we can talk about perception in a sort of mechanical way like this and even admit that, you know, even describe with some great deal of precision the degree to which the organism is passive, the degree to which the faculty, as you just put it, is active and rises to the occasion in that one of its potentialities is activated. But yet, as I was saying before, it is being acted upon more than acting. And this, I think, is important later because the thing that acts without being affected is better.
Right. So intellect will be, yeah.
Yes, yes. The intellect, the pure intellect.
Yeah, we don't need to be impressed upon by objects of thought in order to think them.
In fact, that it can't. That's going to be one of the problems, is how you could have an overweening intellect like that, that it could survive separate from the body, that is not restricted to space and time. The thing that Thomas Aquinas and a million other Christians jumped on and said, yes, Aristotle's our guy, but yet also have this picture of the intellect being much like perception in that it adopts the forms of the things that you perceive or, in the case of the intellect, think about. So there have to be multiple parts of the intellect. We can sort of just treat this as we go through the text, but if you guys had any sort of initial reactions on what you thought of Aristotle as this revolutionary figure in that sense, maybe this is not a bad place to introduce them.
I'm getting stuck on the word revolutionary just because he predates all that stuff. So,
how about revelatory figure?
The story that you just described, Mark, makes me think of the way in which one of the themes in biology in the late 19th century and early 20th century was how to capture this activity of organisms that seems to be more than the sum of its parts. And so there were tracks that of scientific thinking that biology was all chemistry, and others that there's something more going on. And you had people who were talking about there being a separate life force, a vis viva, that was sort of completely separate, super added on top of the chemistry, and that was part of what all living things had. But then you had other people appropriating directly and self-consciously Aristotle, even using words like entelechia to describe that part of organisms that as activity is self-moving, that is more than just the sum of its parts. Whitehead is also doing something like this, trying to figure out a way to having things be more than the sum of their parts, which is one way of thinking about what Aristotle's doing, is he has a way of speaking of organisms as being wholes that are not merely reducible to their parts right from the get-go. And so he's sort of a natural place to sit if you're looking for a really smart guy who thought about this a long time ago to help you get out of that conundrum of, I have a whole bunch of stuff stacked together, but I can't figure out how they become a living thing.
Which, bringing up the vis viva and this sort of, I don't know, discredited strain in biology, if that, at least the way we talked about it in our Schopenhauer episode, our first Schopenhauer episode, was any indication, makes it sound like, yeah, and that was actually following in the footsteps of Aristotle. And that's exactly why we don't, Aristotle is not a current figure, that he's beyond dead science. And the way that Bernyat in his article described this is that just Aristotle would say there's something like the vis viva and then think that that can just be fundamental and doesn't really require any further of what we would think of as a scientific explanation, that a scientific explanation involves being able to connect it to lower levels. So that's the goal, you know, been the goal in all of philosophy, to say that to cash out psychology in terms of biology and cash out biology in terms of chemistry, cash out chemistry in terms of physics, etc. And so the fact that he's not trying to do that, there's something wrong with that. And then in the response paper, Wes, did you spend more time with Putnam and Anderson than I did? The response to that if I remember correctly, is kind of what Dylan said, that no, there's an acknowledgement that, of course, there is a situatedness in the physical. It's not saying that the vis viva is like a soul that came down from heaven and inserted itself into something, and it could insert itself into different things. And that's just that way it happened to be, that there's something very specific.
So I don't remember this vis viva part, but...
I don't want you to saddle Aristotle with that part about it.
They're having a specific conversation about whether Aristotle's a functionalist and whether sensation is just this basic, inexplicable thing that has no physiological basis, or whether it does have this physiological basis. And to say a functionalist, by the way, is just to say that the matter, in a way, is incidental. You could, as long as you can get the same functions, it could be made of silicon, or we could be made of, you know, of something else entirely, but that it's the function, not the particular material, the flesh and bone, that's important.
So this distinction of hardware and software.
Bernyard is taking a minority view. It's not just Nussbaum and Putnam, but any commentary you read on Aristotle, I've never read another commentary that agrees with Bernyard. So we should make him out to be a... I know he's a famous Aristotle scholar, but I don't think he has a majority view on this. This is a pretty radical interpretation of Aristotle.
It's the Christian interpretation, right?
Well, there's that discussion at the end of the Putnam Nussbaum article about... Bernyard self-consciously calls it Christian. They take some issue with his interpretation of Aquinas and so forth.
Yeah.
Anyway, I didn't want us to get bogged down on those articles, even though they make good background reading.
No, but as a high level, you know, to get at what is at stake in this discussion, if this is perhaps the first text in the philosophy of mind, then it is giving a particular position, which there is some disagreement among commentators about, regarding the mind-body problem. And one way of getting at that, you know, the connection to functionalism is just this distinction between form and matter, that talking about the soul as a form and giving a sort of schematic picture of it as, well, the soul is made up of these parts and faculties, without feeling like you have to then talk about the matter. Now, Aristotle does talk about the matter, apparently not so much in this text as in other texts. And he doesn't give any indication that I can see, as a functionalist who, you know, wants to argue that artificial intelligence is possible, that, say, the form of a human could be on any other kind of matter. In fact, this text seems to argue pretty strongly against that, that just like a sense is designed to pick up certain sensory objects, so the human body has a particular potential, and it's not going to get imbued with the soul of a frog or something. You know, it's very specific to the particular kind of matter involved. But the fact is, we're still giving a form-level account.
But when we say it's specific to the matter, right, we can mean many things by matter. And when we say matter in this particular situation, we don't mean atoms, and we don't mean even fire, earth, air, and water, because matter is a relative term. And for Aristotle, the next level down from soul is functional organism or organs. So the matter of the soul is just the functional arrangement of the organs. It's not matter in the way we think of matter. And then the matter of those organs is fire, earth, air, and water. It's a tiered thing. And that's the argument for reading him as a functionalist. The matter for the soul could itself have any kind of matter you like, as long as it's organized correctly.
Well, that kind of blew my mind when I hit it in the Gendlin halfway in, where he says, hey, remember that when Aristotle says matter, he doesn't mean stuff. He doesn't mean the physical stuff, which is what I always thought. You know, even if he doesn't mean atoms, he at least means the four elements. But he gives the example of the matter of the number two is the whole sequence of numbers. So it's like the range of possibilities, the environment in which the thing asserts its individuality, something like that.
Or just like the matter of a statue, for instance, might be bronze. But bronze itself is informed. It's a structured thing of material elements, earth, air. It's some combination of earth, air, fire, and water. So you see how these tiers work. Most of the things that we're, when we say that the bricks and the rest of it are the matter for the house, we obviously don't mean it's the ultimate stuff of things, you know, what we would think of as atoms or subatomic particles. We just mean the next tier down, the relevant stuff, and it is stuff, but something that's functionally relevant to what we're doing, right? We don't pick up atoms and stick them together to make a house. We pick up bricks and do that.
If you just showed up with a giant bucket of protons, electrons, and neutrons, you wouldn't be able to make a house out of it. You have to have bricks or wood or whatever. You have to have a specific arrangement of them.
This isn't just a reading of commentators, fancy reading of things. This is something Aristotle very explicitly talks about.
Yes, I think the reason it was just surprising in here is because he doesn't talk about it here so much. It's something that's in the metaphysics, which we will get to at another time.
How many times have you said that, Mark?
I won't say it again. That was the last time.
I think that's the single most repeated phrase on PEL is we will read Aristotle's metaphysics.
Do we read the metaphysics first or the physics?
No.
The physics has the argument for final causation, which is absolutely, I've learned in my researches over the last few weeks, stunningly fascinating. And I didn't even know Aristotle had made such a sustained argument. Anyway, I'm distracting us, but for another time, as Mark would say. So do we want to get back to...
Yes, back to the
text. Sensation. I don't know. Do we want to jump forward past the sensation as harmony?
I mean, that's an interesting point for folks that listen to our original Aristotle on Ethics episode way back when, that if you come away with one phrase from that, it's the golden mean. Don't be too strong. Don't be too excessive in one way or another, and you'll probably end up right. And he actually hooks that right back to perception, right? If you think that the organ perceives by taking on the form somehow of the thing it perceives. And I keep saying somehow because it's not like, well, like I said in our last episode, that some commentators do think like the eye fluid actually turns red when you see red. But Nussbaum and Putnam have convinced me that that is not necessary, that you could interpret that in a way that is much more in tune with current physiology. Somehow the brain has to represent the letter A or something in some way. It's not that if you look with a microscope, you see the letter A there.
Yeah. We talk about representation. We talk about making pictures of the world. You know, we saw in early Wittgenstein, he's still thinking in terms of a picturing, even though it's the logical structure that does the picturing. So in that sense, it's not so foreign that to think that in some sense that there's a likeness of some sort, that the form of a thing is taken into us. It's just the question of what we mean by that. And yeah, we can take that more literally and say the eye jelly turns red. But it's more interesting to think about it less literally.
And since I distracted myself with the eye jelly stuff, can somebody remind me what was said right before I started that?
We were talking about the harmony section, the idea that the sense organ has to be in a mean between, you know, say the extremes of hot and cold, if it's to be sensitive to both.
I recall that when I got into the commentary, that making more sense than it does right now saying it, because hot and cold, the hand, it feels things hotter than it is hot and cool things as cold. But does that mean that it's in a magic mean? I mean, it just seems like that if something is too cold, it damages the hand, like Dylan was saying. If something is too hot, it will damage the hand. But that just means it has a range that it can take in. It doesn't mean that it's the perfect mean, and you can think of the level of pitches that dogs can hear versus the level of pitches that we can hear. Why would we think that ours is the perfect mean? And that
where is the perfect mean part in here, Mark?
We are looking at, I don't know if he specifically says mean in this. I think in chapter 2 he mentions it specifically, but in the
Dylan's translation does not have any of these words.
So we're looking at,
I don't think mine did either.
426A,
just before 426B, right? Stuff on harmony.
Read it.
Yeah, so in my translation, he says, now if harmony is a sort of voice, and the voice and hearing are one in a certain way, while in another way, not one or the same thing, and harmony is a logos, then the hearing has also to be a logos. Because of this, each kind of excess, both the sharp and the flat, destroys the hearing, and excesses in flavor destroy taste, and in colors, the excessively bright or obscure destroys vision. And in smell, it is the strong smell, both sweet and bitter, just as though it is a certain logos of the sense. The pleasure also derives from this. For whenever things like the sharp and the sweet and the salty, from being pure and unmixed, are drawn toward a logos, then they are pleasant. And in general, it is the mixed rather than the sharp or the flat that is a harmony.
So in my translation, it's logos is translated as ratio, which I think is pretty typical.
Or proportion, I've got,
in this context,
Yeah, so he's transliterated logos.
So we're mixing things.
Yeah, but here it seemed to me that he was just saying that there is a harmony in these senses and a range, just exactly the way you were talking, Mark, not a mean.
Yeah, I think Mark was sort of calling back that he talks of the mean, I think, in chapter two. I'll just read a little bit from this. It's 423b. This is why we have no sensation of what is a hot, cold, hard, or soft as we are, but only of what is more so, which implies the sense is a sort of mean between the relevant sensible extremes. That is how it can discern sensible objects. It is the mean that has the power of discernment, for it becomes an extreme in relation to each of the extremes in turn. And just as that which is to perceive white and black must be actually neither, but potentially both, and similarly with other senses, so in the case of touch, it must be neither hot nor cold. So, and it connects into this idea of potentiality as well.
You know? Exactly. And so I didn't read that as it being a kind of golden mean. I read it as the senses have to have that range. I mean, I would have easily substituted the language of range and being able to perceive both the hot and the cold.
Well, I'm bringing the golden in here really because of this new stuff in book three here. I mean, think of it with music as the obvious way that by saying that hearing is a kind of proportion and the aesthetics is built in to this. So he say things are pleasant when brought pure and unmixed to the proportion, but in general, a mixture, you know, you can think of when he's talking about a voice, what makes a voice rich and sound good to us is that it has particular overtones. Though you might think, as Plato did, I think Gendlin points this out, Plato says, really, the best kind of music is just one note at a time. I want to really be able to hear that note. And Aristotle's saying, no, actually, even though that is nice, it's pleasant when it's brought pure and unmixed to the proportion. But think about just eating salt, for instance. Like, clearly with taste, it's better to have a pleasant mixture of stuff. Though it's hard to say with tastes, you know, you could sort of make up, say, oh, you have to have exactly the right ratio of cinnamon to nutmeg or whatever the thing is. But with music, it's much clearer that you can say mathematically what makes a major chord so pretty and say a lot of other similar things like that, both about the richness of a particular tone and its overtones or about a whole symphony presented in combination.
So I think that you're right that the aesthetics is coming in along with it. So to the extent that you're going to have some kind of golden harmony or relation, then bringing the aesthetics in right along with the perception there and saying why it's pleasant to us.
Because it's optimized to the sense, and the sense itself is not random. The senses are optimized for us. They're optimized for our environment, for our survival.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to draw too much. I know other philosophers like Pythagoras and maybe Plato would have drawn more connection between the sense of hearing and the fact that it is optimized to enjoy a major chord, say, and then the mathematics involved in the major chord, that it's not an accident that we are optimized to enjoy beauty in this way. It's not just a peculiarity of our biology. That beauty is, yes, it is accordance with our biology, but in turn, the biology is somehow in accord with nature as a whole or something larger.
Yeah.
The spheres.
Because nature is mathematical.
Exactly. It's a logos, man.
Yeah. But even if you just stuck with the biology part, the fact that we derive pleasure or are, you know, attracted by certain combinations of sounds or tastes or, in fact, repelled by certain combinations of sounds and tastes, and that's intrinsically related to our biology, is something that you can pick up any number of books or magazine articles about that being the case based upon modern science and biology. And Aristotle would have said, well, of course, that's what I thought, too.
Told you so.
It took you 2,500 years to figure that out? Really?
I'm Aristotle. Told you so. I want to jump to chapter three here, the relation between sensation and thinking.
Well, before we talk about thinking, let's actually wrap up part one here and talk about thinking next time. Even though we advertised this was going to be all about thinking. Psych. It was just about sensation, and thinking is next time. So,
but you have the sensation of wanting to become a member and get this whole thing all at once.
That's right. You don't have to wait for part two for next week. With your partially examined life citizenship for a mere $5, you can get it right now. So do it and buy a calendar.
Yes, that tingling you're feeling in your pineal gland, that's the urge to buy things. One of the basic senses.
Hey, folks, we're going to follow through and actually have an after show this time. An after show is a live event reflecting on these episodes, these De Anima episodes, that you can watch on YouTube live as it's happening, or if you become a partially examined life citizen, you can even participate in the after show. This will take place on January 31st, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific Time. Wes will be on it. Our good friend Danny Lobel will be on it, at the very least. This is your opportunity to ask the questions you want to ask, to dive in yourself and try to figure out what De Anima is about. To participate, you have to sign up for Partially Examined Life's Not School. That is, just become a Partially Examined Life citizen. And look under Not School Groups. You sign up for this. You get yourself signed into Google Hangout. And you will receive an invite to join the meeting shortly before it starts. And now let's hear Nathan tell us more about what's going on in Not School right now.
Hey everyone, this is Nathan Hanks. I have a couple of brief updates from our Citizens Forum and Not School. Now, members get together in the Citizens Forum to talk about things and get groups together for readings and conversation. Topics like Nietzsche's Death of God. If you want to get into something more serious, try supporting Hegel's Science of Logic. They're looking for a few readers to get going on that read. Members have also got groups going forward right now. You may still be able to get in on them. There's Homo Sacer by Giorgio Agamben, Consciousness Explained by Daniel Dennett, and Intro to Analytic Philosophy. That's all in the Citizens Forum, and that's for members. If you're not one now, just a regular listener that would like to support some good people and get in on a good conversation, I can't think of a better way. It's pretty easy. If you have any questions, just contact me. That's Nathan at partiallyexaminedlife.com. Thank you for listening.